everyone, and welcome to this session, which is brought to you by Custodio, a leading independent parental control and wellbeing app for families. My name is Georgie Powell, and I'm a digital wellbeing expert. And I'm very happy today to be joined by Giancarlo Pitocco, who is the founder of Purposeful Digital Wellbeing and works in a very similar field to myself. He's on a mission to help families and teams reclaim their attention, wellbeing, and lives from the powerful grips of destructive technology. And today on Digital Wellness Day, we're here to talk a bit about what digital wellbeing really is and what we've learned over the past few weeks during the COVID pandemic as our lives have increasingly been moving online. So without further ado, Giancarlo, it's fantastic to have you on board. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Georgie.
Oh, it's so great to have you. And I'm really excited about this conversation because I think we've got a lot to learn from each other. But before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts, can you just tell me a bit about your background and how you ended up doing what you're doing today?
Oh boy, that's an interesting story. I'll try to keep it brief so we can get into the juicy bits we should be talking about here today. So in 2016, I found myself working at a company called Facebook, working across the Facebook and Instagram products. I was on a team studying the way that technology influences how we think, feel, communicate. And that's pretty much the theme of my career leading up to that. But 2016, I joined Facebook, and at the end of that year, as you might remember, for those of us in the U.S., we feel it particularly powerfully, the 2016 election happened, and we quickly learned the role that Facebook may or may not have, at the time, played in the outcome of that election, or at least in influencing voters through dissemination of propaganda from foreign governments. What I saw inside the company, and we all saw in the press at the time, was the leadership of Facebook and Instagram quickly dismissed that as if like, no, what are you talking about? We're just like a fun little diversion for people. We're not influencing humanity at any kind of meaningful scale. And that really shook me because I knew that we reached over 2.5 billion people at the time across those platforms that we controlled. So this led to me starting to notice the role of technology in my own life and paying attention that if it's having that much influence on the outcome of human events like our elections, what's it doing to me personally? As someone who grew up surrounded by technology, I always felt like I had a leg up on it. I was good at understanding how to use it and how to teach others how to get the most out of it. So I was always kind of skeptical about the whole, like, is technology controlling you or are you controlling technology? But that moment in time gave me pause. And so I went through this journey, I'll fast forward a bit, to remove as much technology from my life as possible while working at one of the world's largest technology companies, and then carefully reintroduce that technology with really clear intentions, really clear purpose, when I saw a need for it, and the usage of that technology far outweighed any downsides of introducing it back into my life. For instance, like if I saw a clear need for having Facebook in my life, what are the downsides that comes with that in terms of its habit-forming newsfeed and other features, dark patterns, all those kinds of things? Is it worth it? Could I defang it? Could I neuter it from being able to distract me as much when I brought it back into my life? So I made a study and a practice of this with technology coming into my life again. And what I saw in a very short period of time was total transformation in the quality of my life, how I used my time, how I thought about the power of my attention. And it was obvious to people around me, both at the company and in my personal life, that something had changed for me, and curiosity rose in them. And there was inquiry about what's going on and teach us your ways, which led to me developing a curriculum around it ultimately, and trying to shop it around inside of Facebook, saying like, hey, you know, I want to be teaching this. If we teach people how to use our platform healthfully, that's a game changer. We reach over 2.5 billion people. But as you might imagine, people were more focused on other goals and more interested in just managing PR rather than actually creating positive change. What's the bare minimum we can do to tell a good story to get people to calm down about the role of our platform in their lives? And that, you know, told me there was clearly a difference in values there. So ultimately, like, I went to Mark in front of the company and questioned him on our values, saying like, we aren't just a fun diversion for college kids anymore. We influence the course of human events. The decisions you make today affect all of us tomorrow. Isn't it time to upgrade our values as a company from just how do we build a successful company, which is what the values were at the time, and might still be, I don't know. And shouldn't we have some values that reflect the fact that we want to have positive impact on the world instead of just building a successful company? Because people are calling us on that right now, and it's showing up in our lives. I've seen it in my life. He wasn't very interested in that, as you might imagine. He said, nope, we're fine. And we already do a lot of good in the world, and we don't need to change anything. Sit down and go back to the work. So I don't know, maybe a few months later, I can't remember the exact timeline. I was out of there and took all the work I had built and launched Purposeful Digital Wellbeing and have been taking that out there. So that's, believe it or not, that was the short version of the story.
But it's a fabulous story. Yeah, it's a fabulous story. So just to understand a little more about Purposeful, just while we're on it. So are you working for, who are your main clients? Individuals, companies, families?
It's very much split between working with families and schools and companies. So for families, it's a lot of one-on-one or like me to a family, kind of doing some coaching or consulting on how to shift their relationship with technology, help them become aware of their unconscious habits that might be holding them back from the kind of life they want to create as a family, helping them communicate with each other about safe and healthy boundaries with technology, and teaching them how to enroll each other in the process versus parents just coming in with this attitude of, my kids have terrible habits, I'm going to tell them that I'm judging their habits and I'm going to force them to change their ways. Meanwhile, the parent is telling me this while they're like checking their phone and scrolling, and I'm like, no, this solution starts with you, and then enrolling your kids in the journey that you go on. Anyway, I digress. So that kind of work with parents, sometimes in a group format, especially if I go through a school. And then on the corporate side, it's going in and working with leaders of organizations who realize that their relationship with productive technology has gotten in the way of actually being productive, where people spend more time managing tools and technology than actually doing the work they're there to do, not having healthy norms or boundaries around when they communicate with each other, when they do work. Really, what I teach across all of this is that our relationship with technology is just a reflection of our relationship with ourselves. And if there's some kind of issue in that relationship with technology, then there's a deeper issue with some unmet needs or some unconscious needs that we have that we're not dealing with. And so I try to wake them up to that. So it's really fun and rewarding work. And it's fun to see it from both of those perspectives.
Yeah, fascinating. So my story is not dissimilar to yours. I've been working as a consultant in media and technology for my career. And I decided to move into industry. And I chose to go to YouTube because at the time I believed in the importance of democratizing content. You know, we were living in a world where three middle-aged white guys were basically programming everything that, that the country that I was living in got to see. And I thought, that's not right. You know, we should be choosing our own content journeys. And that's exactly what YouTube offers. And in many ways, that's what it still offers. And it's a great value that you get to choose your content journey. And working for Google, who, for those of you who don't know, owns YouTube, was a fantastic experience. I'd love to step inside Facebook and see how maybe it differs from stepping inside Google, because I do still believe that at the heart of that company, there is a value to genuinely make the world a better place. But the reality was, a bit like with Facebook, I was working on a product that had a business objective, which was to drive revenue. And in order to do that, you have to hold people's attention. And so I quickly kind of came to realizing that my ultimate goal in the role that I had was to get people to watch more YouTube. And actually, it didn't matter what they were watching, so long as they were spending more time watching YouTube. So, and at the same time, this is sort of back probably around 2014, I started to realize my own relationship with technology wasn't good. And I think it's certainly the case that some of us are more sensitive to it than others. And I recognize that I was someone that was sensitive to it. You know, I was very sensitive to the impact of social validation that I was experiencing on social media. I was very sensitive to whether or not I should always be working, and the impression that I gave at work and working very hard and kind of making sure I was always visible and never really giving myself the right space. And I kind of became more and more aware of that. And so I started to look around for solutions which could help me, tools that could help me to manage my phone life balance. And at that time, there were only a few. There was one called Moment, which obviously still is around, and there was Off Time, and there was a product called Break Free. And I reached out to the people who had created Break Free in Reagan and Nepal, and together we decided to work to overhaul that product, Break Free, and we launched it in 2017 as a product called Space. So Space was one of the original screen time apps that helped you track your screen usage, and it kind of nudged you towards better habits. We were named one of the new and noteworthy apps in the Google Play Store in the beginning of 2018. We had a couple of million downloads. It's a very successful little product, and it was really nice to feel like what we were doing was genuinely helping people to be more aware of their technology habits. And yeah, that was really my kind of first foray into digital wellbeing. I left Google and focused purely on Space. The product has subsequently, it's still available, but obviously a lot of what we do or did is very similar now to what's provided as standard on devices. So our company now actually focuses primarily on research. So we work with universities around the world to help them collect the data that they need to understand these issues more. And then I work for a number of different companies, helping them to understand digital wellbeing better. And Custodio is my primary client right now. And it's been a joy to work with them to kind of help them think about how parental control apps can also foster positive digital habits amongst families as well, and get families to think really positively about how to work with technology, exactly to your point, to kind of support family values. As well as keeping kids safe. So
you can create a nice container around the kind of experience you're creating, setting some boundaries and having the technology support you in it, I think is a wonderful thing. Because you could look at parental controls, and I think some folks could have an adverse reaction to that philosophically, like, oh no, we just need to buck up and try harder and live better on our own without the support of that. But I disagree. I think it's like having technology support you and put some boundaries in place to help you get used to what is it like to live with some limits on this when we've grown up with just technology thrown into our lives and it's like, hey, figure it out without much guidance. But now even just the settings that you have to choose from in a parental control solution helps you recognize like, oh, I never thought about putting limitations on that or boundaries here or there or needing to have a conversation about any of this stuff. So I think it's really great for that. It's just a way to have technology reflect what your values are. It's almost like here's your blank slate of settings. Now imprint your values on this.
I completely agree. And it's funny because when I first started, I think in the UK in particular, I think there's quite a strong sometimes this aversion to this concept of control. But I don't see it like that. I see it as it's not appropriate to let your child at the age of 10 or 11, whenever you give them their first smart device, and obviously that age is up for debate as it is.
Totally.
But it's not appropriate to let them have access to the entirety of the internet. Just as if you let them go out for a walk on their for their first time or to see a friend for their first time, you wouldn't let them get on a flight and fly around the world. You know, there would be restrictions around it. It would be, you would have thought it through. It would be step by step. And so in parental control tools, actually they allow access to technology at a level which is appropriate to a child's digital literacy or, personal level of development or social awareness, whatever it might be. And it gives people the ability, as you say, to have the right conversations with their kids about what is appropriate and what's not. And it also does force parents to step up to understand the technology that they're letting their kids play on, because that's a really important piece of the puzzle as well. So there's a really important space for those products.
That's the thing I would love to see over time is the ability to hand over technology to someone without having to hand over the full power of it. How do we, and I think that's what parental control solutions allow us to do right now is hand over that technology with some boundaries in place. Like you said, like, you know, it's wonderful that we have air travel and can go anywhere in the world. And I hope my kid someday is, you know, a globetrotter and curious and wanting to see much of the world. But like there's a time for that in their development when it's appropriate to do it. Right now, yeah. We're handing over these powerful tools that give you access to all of the world's content, knowledge, so many people around the world that, hey, you know, you don't need to be having that kind of power as a child who's never lived outside the bounds of our home and the safety of two parents, you know? So it's like handing over, I don't know, you want to give them a tool to like learn how to start building using a hammer and nail, but it's like actually the only thing we can give you is a jackhammer.
Exactly.
Some kind of crazy, I don't know, whatever the industrial sized, industrial scale version of a hammer is.
Yeah, don't point it at your heart.
Yeah.
Okay, so just kind of coming back to digital well-being then, because I think it's obviously a term which I think before Google launched its product, I hadn't actually heard it even mentioned as a term. But I think there were a lot of us that were discussing it as a concept. We just hadn't found the words that were kind of universally useful. But since that term digital well-being has kind of evolved, I still don't feel like there is a global consensus around the definition of what it really is. So I'm always really interested in kind of, you know, Giancarlo, what's your definition? How do you define digital well-being? What is digital well-being to you?
I think universally we're all talking about using technology in a way that's healthy for our mind, body, and spirit. The way I talk about this is digital well-being as a practice of using technology in service of your needs, your values, or your aspirations, rather than as a habitual distraction from it, as we typically use it. It shouldn't be carrying you away from those things. It should be helping you live more in accordance with those needs, values, aspirations. So anytime you have a question about, is this a healthy use of technology, or is this technology good for me? It comes back to those three areas, needs, values, aspirations. And the interesting thing about that definition is that it is forcing people to go a layer deeper. Do I know what my needs, my values, my aspirations are well enough to know how can technology come in and support me in those things? Mm. And many of the people that I work with want to go that layer deeper. And they're like, let me get really clear on those needs, values, aspirations. Really meaning, what kind of life am I creating, and by what am I navigating in my day-to-day, weekly, monthly, yearly choices? What's guiding those decisions in terms of my needs? Am I in touch with my needs? Do I know what my values are as an individual, as a family, as a partner? And do I know what I aspire to in terms of the kind of life I want to create for myself, with my family, for my kids? And am I living that every day? And then it's like, okay, what's the role of technology in supporting me on these things? So the way I approach it, it's really like digital well-being is a bit of a Trojan horse into living more intentionally or purposefully, as is in the namesake, the company that I have. Being more purposeful takes care of all of this, in my opinion.
I love the word you use, technology to serve our needs, values, and aspirations. You know, this kind of, this reminder that technology is here as a tool to make our lives better. You know, if we can consciously connect with it, if we can choose how we want to really use it. But how do you go about with people, let's take a family, for instance, how do you go about the process of helping them to really understand what their needs or their values or aspirations might be? Because as you say, that can be a life's work for someone. That's kind of, if you get that sorted, I think you've done pretty well. So how do you get people to simply think about that?
Well, the first thing is to dispel the myth or notion that knowing how to live purposefully is some unattainable accomplishment that's very rare. Our culture just doesn't promote doing that. From the moment we're born, we're surrounded by media and stimulation of other people's ideas, right? Whether it's the television and commercials and TV shows and news feeds and digital screens and apps and billboards. I mean, we're just bombarded with ideas that are reinforcing, here's how you should live. Here's a model for how other people live. And we're absorbing that all day long. And we don't really leave a lot of time for solitude or getting grounded in, well, what does our intuition say about what we really want here? And knowing your purpose can be as simple as just listening to what is your strongest desire inside for what choice you want to make. Could be what you're having for dinner tonight. It could be for deciding what career path you're going to take. We so often drown out what our inner voice is saying in favor of the loud noises that we hear outside from everyone else around us telling us what the safe, secure, popular path is through life. So it's dispelling this notion that it's really hard to figure out what your life's purpose is. And it doesn't have to be writing this manifesto that says, this is what I stand for and I'm all about. It's really an act of favoring your inner intelligence over the influences of the outside world. And so I'll use tools like the Wheel of Life, which is a popular coaching tool for breaking down the important facets of life that if you're doing well in these areas, you'll have an overall sense of meaning and fulfillment. And the most powerful part of this tool is that it creates awareness of the different facets of life that you've maybe never broken down into their distinct parts. Maybe it's relationships, career, finances, home environment, so on and so forth. It really breaks them all out into distinct sections and then gives you the tools and systems for exploring it and evaluating how you're doing in those different facets of life and creating a plan for, well, what's the next best thing I can do to level up in this area? And all of a sudden, what you walk away with is a set of priorities and goals for where you're headed. And that right there creates a more purposeful life. Because instead of just waking up and looking at, well, what's in my calendar and waiting for me in my inbox and notifications waiting on my screen because I use my phone as my alarm clock and letting that lead you through your day, all of a sudden you've looked at what is essentially a roadmap for getting to the kind of life you want to create. And that gives you purpose every day in choosing how to spend your time. And then it's like, okay, well, how does technology help me live in that way? So I've just oversimplified the journey a great deal to illustrate the point that really just taking a look at different facets of your life, evaluating them and deciding what would a 10 out of 10 in those areas be? What are the next simple steps I can take to get towards it? Little things. All of a sudden, you have a greater sense of purpose and you're moving towards a life experience that is more of your own design rather than just unconsciously letting everything outside of us lead us through our days. Number one being our phones, right? They command our attention. Buzzes, notifications, dings, scheduled appointments, inboxes, text messages. We allow all of these things to just kind of lead us by our noses through life every day without thinking, what do I need to be working on today to feel better about life, to design a life that's more in line with what I want, what I aspire to?
That's fascinating and brilliant. And certainly, some of the child psychologist experts that I've been connecting with since working at Custodio, many of them talk about how the best way to manage screen time with children is very similar, you know, to have in place family values and to use that as discussion point for why screen time has a place and then when perhaps it doesn't, because you've decided that, for instance, family meal times are a sacred spot and that's a time where you mm-hmm. come together and you have real connections. And so it's not appropriate for a screen to be at the table, or you know, that actually as a family, you really care about learning and there's a space for technology in that, but it's not the only thing that's going to help you learn. And so, you know, it makes it easier to have, I guess, a kind of a conversation where you're all on the same page if you've all agreed into the values of what you're trying to live by. So I personally thought that was a really helpful parenting approach. My approach to digital being is very similar to you, although less grounded in that deeper value piece. Although I fully agree with what you're saying, and it's absolutely brilliant. But for me, it's more simply just the conscious connection. It's the way that we consciously use technology to help us thrive both as individuals and as society. And that to me is about making sure you're aware of your connections. So when you're connecting and why, the content that you're either consuming or sharing, you know, do you trust it? Is it making you feel better? Yeah. Are you actually building the relationships you want to build? The care. So getting better at kind of actually assessing the overall impact, like the net sentiment, I guess, on our life of the way that we're interacting with technology and our habits. And then the control element as well, of just being able to kind of be in check of whether or not these interactions are actually always in our control. Like, are we the masters really of the way that we're using technology? To your point, is technology serving us? So, but I think what's really interesting in both our definitions of both our approaches is there isn't any mention in there of a digital detox. because that's not realistic. You know, digital well-being is about an awareness and opening your eyes to these fantastic tools, but being able to choose when the right time is to incorporate them in our lives and when's not. And so maybe a detox can help shed some light on that initial, but that is not necessarily the ultimate route to digital well-being.
I totally agree with the digital detox thing. I've had so many people say, oh, when are you going to run a digital detox retreat or program or something? And I think here's what's great about a digital detox is it creates contrast that you might not have ever recognized before by showing you what the other end of the spectrum is like in terms of a life with a minimal amount of technology or no technology. And it creates this awareness of that. So that might not exist otherwise. And then it can be a powerful motivator for people, but it's not always practical. And so what are the ways that people can, in their everyday lives, start doing this? I think it's a much more interesting and more nuanced conversation, which is what both of us are talking about here, rather than this extreme, oh, you're going to go to Bali and you're not going to use technology for a week or two. And it's like, okay, but how many of us can just like pick up and disappear for these detoxes? And how practical is it to do it in your own life, especially if you're, you know, working with childcare providers and your school and everything? There's a lot to juggle there in terms of just communication that you need tech for to keep things rolling. And that's, you know, there are beautiful uses of technology that makes our lives better. We need to focus on that. And to your point, create that awareness of how we connect with it, how we use it. And you can work with that instead of having to go to these extremes. Let other people do that and learn from their experiences. I went to that extreme and I'm telling people everything they need to know from having gone on that journey so that they don't have to go as extreme as I did. And it sounds like you did as well. And so, you know, as two people who have gone to great lengths, we've come back and have decided to share our learnings from that in a way that's like, hey, you don't have to do what I did, but here's what you need to know.
yeah, exactly.
It's much more doable.
It's just, let's find sustainable solutions here that actually work in real life.
Amen.
So I'd love to sort of just understand just briefly why actually is digital well-being so important? Why are we even talking about this? Like, why? and I'm always fascinated because I think I get a bit worried that maybe it's a topic which is purely for the, you know, it's a topic of the privileged, you know, we're kind of, we're ex-techies, we're all sitting around in our little educated lives saying, oh, you know, let's improve our digital well-being. We clearly both think it's incredibly important, which is why we're dedicating our lives to it. But why do you think it's important? Like, why are you so into this?
So we have a situation right now where as a species, we have some pretty big challenges that we're up against right now in terms of making ourselves sustainable as a species and having a good life. There are big problems that we need to solve. How are we going to do that if everyone's got their face buried in a news feed on a little screen that they carry around, or maybe soon will be strapped to their faces or embedded in their brains, right? If we as a population are so inappropriately distractible that we're not tending to the needs of our own survival by taking care of this planet or figuring out how we're going to feed everyone and so on and so forth, what are we doing? We're giving up our long-term survivability in favor of entertainment and comfort and convenience. And we are surrendering our autonomy. We're saying, look, Just plug me into an income, give me creature comforts in my home, an endless stream of entertainment on the little box sitting in my living room, an app to order some food delivered to my home, a bottle of wine that's also delivered through an app that I can drink until I fall asleep at night, for those who are single without kids. and just rinse and repeat. Yeah. And do that over and over again. So, I mean, I'm being extreme in this illustration. What I'm saying is that digital well-being is important because technology has become the number one distractor and harvester of our time. So things like social media have been engineered to be habit-forming. The more of our time and attention they gather, the more inventory they have to sell. Their product is our time and attention that they sell to advertisers, or take for competitive reasons, like Netflix charges a subscription and wants to, you know, keep you tuned in as much as possible so you don't look at their competitor YouTube and stealing ad revenue from them. So there's this war for our attention, and it's stealing us away from our own lives. That's why it's so important. Your time and your attention are things that you can't get back. Your attention is the one power nature has given you for creating your life. This is what I tell people is the one thing I want them to remember most. Use the power of your attention with intention, because it is your tool for creating the kind of life you want to live and navigating the experience of life. And what you choose to apply your attention to becomes your life. And it can only be expressed over time. Time is something we can't get back. And we're giving it away to technology to look at another funny cat video online and then be shown an ad for something that we probably don't need. And so we're surrendering our most precious power and resources for the financial benefit of these technology companies. And what are we left with? Yeah, like, it's fun to be on social media sometimes, but it's also fun to eat dessert. And I can't live off of, you know, ice cream sundaes or digital Doritos the rest of my life. Man cannot live on these things alone. You need a balanced diet. If at the end of your life, it was full of funny cat videos and likes, comments, and shares online, you're probably not going to feel good about the quality of your life. People at the end of their life want to look back and feel like they created something that had meaning for them. You don't find meaning in the newsfeed. You don't find meaning by poking around at a little sliver of glass, aluminum, and silicon in your hand. It comes from the interactions with human beings you care about and contributing to the world in a way that makes you feel a sense of meaning and purpose and that you mattered. And that doesn't happen if we're just distracting ourselves all the time with this stuff. So that's why I think this is important.
I love that, because life is what you pay attention to.
Amen.
Amen. I agree. And one of the things I talk about is how, and it's the term digital addiction is highly sensitive and controversial. So right. I try and stay away from it. And I just say, many of us have bad habits, which are detracting from the way that we're living our lives. And that's happening despite the fact that we're using these devices, which actually have a number of physical barriers to them really being useful. You know, we have to hold our phones in our hands, which renders us disabled whilst we're doing that. We drop them. They run out of battery. They get hot. And yet, despite that, we still have developed these habits with them. There is still friction in that technology environment, and yet we have these habits. And to your point on at some point, it's going to be in our eyes or in our heads. I think people think we're kind of technoskeptic to fear that time, or to say apply caution to that time, because I don't think it's far away. You know, audio activated services are getting much better. It won't be long before, instead of being one way, they're two way. We're going to be interrupted in our homes in ways that we're not necessarily prepared for. We're going to be interrupted in our cars. Technology will become more and more pervasive, seamless, better. You know, these barriers and this point of friction will increasingly fall away. And if we're not conscious of how we're controlling our use of these devices now, then there's no way that we're going to be able to apply some kind of awareness and autonomy, you know, that really important word, to the way that we interact with technology in the future. And so now it's about how fast can we upskill ourselves so that we are the masters and we are using these services to aid and abet our lives. honestly, whilst we still can. So I think that's, to me, is why it's really important.
Yes, Georgie. Oh my goodness. So true. I mean, from that practical sense, like, it is becoming more and more invasive. I like to remind people that there was a time when technology could not beckon for our attention.
Yes.
There was a time when humans had to decide when to use and pay attention to any form of technology in their lives. And perhaps the telephone was the first time we invited technology into our homes that could summon us. Maybe outside of a doorbell in their most primitive forms in upscale homes. It certainly wasn't commonplace. But at least then it was a human is trying to reach you over a distance or is standing outside of your home waiting to interact with you. So even that stage of our relationship with technology being able to capture our attention and draw us in was drawing us into a human experience rather than one that is primarily technological and for profit. There's no profit in answering your doorbell for anyone except for you and the other person, hopefully, well, unless it's a salesperson on the other side trying to sell you some irons or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a nice reframe, is to remember that we could also turn off all those notifications and decide when we pay attention to our technology. That's like mind-blowing for some folks.
Yeah, that feels like a big step in many ways, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So we've obviously been in this. We were talking about it before we started recording. We're living this global experiment right now of online life. And I've become very aware that it's not a life that is necessarily accessible for everyone. I think it's really emphasized the extent of the digital divide in our economies. And there are actually a huge number of people who are excluded from this online world because...
That's right.
They don't have access to technology they need, or they don't have the education and services that they need to get on. And that, I think that is also part of digital wellbeing, you know, making sure that people actually can use the technology in the first place. But perhaps that's a conversation for another day. But what I'm interested in is that the cohort of society that is now living their life online, you know, I think we've learned a huge amount in the last 6 weeks from that time about digital wellbeing. And I'm really interested to hear your observations, Giancarlo, about what you think COVID has taught us about digital wellbeing, or what you've noticed and observed yourself.
It's making the extremes really clear and obvious to people. The extremes of what is the value of technology in a really meaningful way that supports me and makes me feel more connected, or supports me in the kind of life I need to live right now, or what I need to have my needs met. But it's also exaggerating the habit-forming parts that don't serve us well for people. Because as a lot of folks say over here to me in the workshops that I lead, is I feel like I'm living through Groundhog's Day, that Bill Murray movie where he keeps waking up to the same day over and over again and is forced to relive it until he learns his lessons, his life lessons and character lessons. And people feel like they're living that right now. And so what it's doing is it's putting this microscope on our daily habits and routines. It's almost like we've all been put into a lab experiment, a controlled environment, this home that we cannot leave. And you can see very clearly how when you have certain habits, use your time in different ways, it makes you feel differently. Because instead of having this variety of stimulation by going out and commuting to an office every day, or going out in the world and going shopping and doing all these things that provide variety, our environment is pretty much the same every day. And so we feel the impact of our habits to a much greater extent. And it becomes much more obvious when we change something, how it makes us feel on the flip side of it, either immediately after or the next day we wake up and we're like, oh, I feel emotionally not great. And it allows us to examine, well, what did I do differently yesterday, without having all the noise of being able to go out in the world and have these variety of experiences. We're facing kind of the same routine every single day. So it's pointing out to people where they have habits that maybe aren't in service of their best interests, but all of that was clouded out because they were so busy in the daily variety of experiences of everyday life. So it's pointing to what's not sustainable for us. And it's pointing to, hey, here's how technology can really be a powerful tool in your life. The number of people that are telling me, like, I never used Zoom before. I never did video chat before. Now I wouldn't know what to do without it. And I'm connecting with people and spending quality time with people that I would normally never have the time to or the will to make plans and arrangements because of great distance or whatever it might have been. I'm listening to people who are reconnecting with people in their lives and spending quality time with them, thanks to the fact that technology's removed the need for logistics. In 2 seconds, you can email someone a link or text them a link to a Zoom hangout. You jump in there and you're spending quality time together. No one had to make any reservations. No one had to figure out transportation and how to get there. It just is instantaneous and it's connection. And though it doesn't give us all the nourishment of in-person connection, it gives us a lot of it. I love talking about Sherry Turkle's work in her book.
I was just about to talk about her as well, because I listened to a podcast she did the other day about how COVID has, you know, as someone who previously was quite skeptical about our relationship with screens, I think she does a really good job now of highlighting how, yes, there are still huge limitations with what technology offers with regards to what we need as humans. But actually what COVID has done is it's forced us to use tools in a way which in many cases is much better than how we used them before. And I loved her comment on, we've seen during this time, this like rise in authenticity, where gone are the kind of all these Instagram posts on these tropical holidays, because none of us are on these tropical holidays. And life, you know, life just got real. And thank goodness the video's off, because you're sitting here, we're recording right now, and I'm sitting here in my hoodies. I'm still wearing my tracksuit. But that's the reality of, you know, working mums at home. We kind of, the facade comes off, and authenticity is also a place where you end up being a lot more vulnerable, and vulnerability leads to strong relationships. And before, the way that we're using technology, often, you know, relying on social media, relying on messaging, on WhatsApp, rather than actually on trying to find this face-to-face or voice-to-voice connection, was cutting that vulnerability out. And actually now we see that once you bring it back in, you can get a lot closer to what we really need as humans. I think that's really, really interesting point that she made. And I think it's so true.
Yeah, she's great. I love that. I love her work on this and helping us understand what we need for actual nourishment from social experiences, and how much of our brain, like what's actually in our skull, exists and evolved for the express purpose of being able to have these social interactions and receive psychological nourishment from them. And the highest form of it being in-person, face-to-face social interactions, where you get that high bandwidth experience of physical touch, facial expressions, gestures, body language, tone of voice, all these things that get stripped out when we try to reduce human interaction down to just a text message. That's why I think emoji and Bitmoji and all those kinds of things are so popular, is because it adds that layer of humanity and that higher bandwidth interaction beyond just raw information, like, hey, here's the language I'm sending you about what I want to communicate to you. Turns out most of our brain is there to process the nonverbal stuff. That's what I love about her work. She breaks this all down, and it kind of gives us what I've framed up in my work as like a hierarchy of social needs or social nourishment. So you know how to create a balanced diet of social interactions and not overindulge in social media as your primary form of interaction with people or text messages, knowing that your brain, your psychology depends, your psychological well-being depends on a richer form of social interaction, and video chat being pretty much the highest form of it you can get to without being in person. And so I love that there's this boom in usage of video chat services. And I'm someone that didn't like that previously. I'm like, just give me a phone call or let's hang out in person. I don't want to have to stare at my screen. But now I'm like, oh man, I don't know what I would do without this. I love it.
Yeah.
Seeing my friends, inviting them into my home. I mean, I fled from my home in New York City in the middle of March to come to where I am now, which is the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm staying with my family. I'm coming to you live from my childhood bedroom right now. So I've never thought I would host so many people. I know folks listening can't see, but like, we're hanging out and looking at each other on Zoom right now, and you're looking at me in my childhood bedroom. I don't know where you are, but it's just amazing how, like, to your point, authenticity is happening, and so many layers of our lives are collapsing into one space and one time. If you're working from home as a parent and you've got the kids coming into your Zoom call and your conference call or your client call, it's like we're becoming more accepting of this and acknowledging that, like, oh yeah, we're humans too. We're not just these machines that show up perfectly polished every time. We have other facets of life. And to your point, I love that we are showing up more authentically. Or I guess it was Sherry's point in the interview.
Yeah, you and showing this authenticity, you know, and the importance of vulnerability, you know, the importance of vulnerability in what we do. I genuinely feel as well that when you talk to people, you know, even if you just connect to them the first time, people do genuinely care how everyone is doing right now. And mm-hmm. that's another thing, which is that's separate to a whole digital wellbeing conversation, but we're actually taking the time to really actually care about how people are. And I hope we don't forget that. I am conscious of the time and we've been talking for a long time and I feel like we could talk probably for the rest of the day, but for now I'm going to wrap up this recording and just say, Giancarlo, thank you so much for coming on board today and having this conversation, because it's just been fantastic and I'm sure that a lot of our users will be really fascinated to hear what you've had to say. So thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, Georgie.
And I hope we stay in touch. Real pleasure. And so thank you very much and take care.